You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. To Sustainable Futures. On the program today, we're going to have two interviews, the second part of a two-part interview with Tim Reeve from Reeve Consulting.
But I think if you just look at the big picture impacts here,
Eagle Ridge Bluffs is a habitat for spotted owl, a lot of grizzly bears, black bears, and
to dispute that for a moment, but in the scheme of the territory that they had available to them before that road was put in place, and the scheme of territory that they have available to them now, all I'm trying to say is that I think the change it has been fairly small.
Also, when you have a four-lane highway, there's a noise associated with a four-lane highway that scares wildlife away. That's why you won't see wildlife in the middle of the city. It's because of the noise. It's not good for them. We're going to debate about the Olympics, and then an interview with Devin Page, the Executive Director of EcoJustice.
This material is at Section 1600 in a 900-page Budget Implementation Act. There's absolutely no way Joe Public could know this was happening. And the government's not saying anything.
I'm Ryan Fletcher. And you're listening to Sustainable Futures. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. This is episode number 52. It's one episode for every week of the year. How about that? So on the show today, we're looking at kind of two sides of a coin here. We've got a lobbyist for a development that was working with the Olympics, Tim Reeve of Reeve Consulting, and he goes by the mantra of sustainable. And we're going to have an interesting little debate about how sustainable some of these things are. And then I'm going to talk with Devin Page of EcoJustice, and EcoJustice is an environmental legal group, and they worked in defense of the environment against parties like lobby groups and government. So it's an interesting look of two sides of one thing here, all in the space of 55 minutes. And the Devin Page interview is the first of a two-episode interview, and Tim Reeve is the second part of a two-episode interview. So next week, we'll have Devin Page. So here's the second part of the interview with Tim Reeve of Reeve Consulting. Okay, I actually want to go more into the environment now, towards the natural environment. Looking at now before the Olympics, as things were going on, there was a really big story about Eagle Ridge Bluffs, and that the four-lane highway that was going there to Whistler and the fact that a natural environment was being really devastated, and there was huge protests about that. And I guess so far as the environmental impact, talking about the natural environment of trees and wildlife, how do you think that's affected due to Olympic concerns?
Personally, I would say that the effect has been almost negligible. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason that I say that is because we already live in effectively an incredibly highly developed region already. Mm-hmm. And as far as the road goes, and I'm not an expert, but I would say that as far as the road goes, you know, from a big picture perspective here, and if we're really thinking about sort of whole scale societal impacts and societal change around sustainability in the long term, whether we put the road overland or through a tunnel, or had simply expanded the road down below, you know, and gone through the cost and engineering of kind of doing that, I don't think either of those three options at the end of the day, in the scheme of this local environment, would really be any kind of impact that we would notice. And that, you know, I think we just have to kind of, you know, I guess the key point I'm trying to make is I think we need to kind of look at these things in scale. If we were going into the middle of a nature reserve that had never had any development in it, like a watershed or something like that, in a wholesale way, you know, I think you might be able to say, holy smokes here, we could be looking at some serious environmental impacts.
What was Eagle Ridge Bluffs? Wasn't that a provincial park of some sort? Or I know there are elements of that are, you know, government land, parkland.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the designation for it was. I'd also heard that there was some plans.
I know
for
there was
future.
Trails. There was trails through there and mm-hmm. things like that
yeah.
for people to walk on.
Yeah, and I think that kind of infrastructure has been maintained, as far as I know. I think there had also been plans that had been put forward to the municipality that might have also looked at different kinds of development in the same area, and so. You know, I just think in terms of, if you look big picture on this Lower Mainland region and kind of where we mm-hmm. are between Hope and Pemberton and the border, and think about where are the big environmental impacts that we have as people. It's, you know, on air quality, it's on major wildlife. Most of the small margin stuff, you know, we've either already so severely impacted it with the development that we have already, and I think we're smart enough to know that on the really, you know, super important stuff, you know, that we're getting wiser and wiser about how we do that. That's not to suggest for a moment that we should do things in an irresponsible way. But I think yeah. if you just look at the big picture impacts here.
Eagle Ridge Bluffs
drinking water
is a habitat for spotted owl, a lot of grizzly bears, black bears, and a lot
not
of these.
Not to dispute that for a moment, but in the scheme of the territory that they had available to them before that road was put in place, and the scheme of territory that they have available to them now, all I'm trying to say is that I think the change it has been fairly small.
Also, when you have a four-lane highway, there's a noise associated with a four-lane highway that scares wildlife away. That's why you won't see wildlife in the middle of the city.
Yeah.
It's because of the noise. It's
yeah.
It's not good for them.
But I think for a black bear or a spotted owl, you know, you're only 150 to 300 meters away from the road that was there already, and it's been there since I was a little kid in West Vancouver, that upper levels highway. You know, I'm not suggesting that there hasn't been an impact. Let's be frank. Sure, there's been an impact. A road has gone through, a tunnel might have gone through, anything has got its impact. I'm just saying that in the scheme of what we've seen over in that area of Horseshoe Bay, probably far more things have had a bigger impact than the choice of road or as a result of that road particularly. But, you know, that's just my own thought on it.
Mm. But then there's just the motivation itself. How are you supporting different, more sustainable transportation when the Olympic Committee, how are they supporting when they're building a four-lane highway that's obviously geared towards more cars?
Yeah, a couple things there. First of all, you know, just to clarify, the Olympic Committee itself isn't the one that was responsible for doing the road.
Yeah.
It's a provincial thing. You
yeah.
know, just but it's important for people to know.
Well, whoever it is, you know.
Ministry of
all
Transportation.
All of them are talking the same talk. So.
And in terms of sort of sustainable transportation legacy, you know, lots of things that were done. In terms of that road itself, I would say that it was more or less a fait accompli that we were going to see some kind of improvements to the highway to Whistler through the Horseshoe Bay and Lions Bay corridor. What solution was going to be chosen, you know, hadn't been determined, but I think people knew you know, ultimately that road needed to be improved. And so those improvements have
been
made.
But then what kind of message does that make? How many people are going to change their transportation behaviors now that there's an extra highway?
Well, I don't think there is an extra highway. There's an expanded highway, an improved route. And some of these things are just going to happen. I mean, we're going to have, we've made a choice as people to use vehicles. We're not going to go to a place where there are no vehicles.
But then a choice is also affected by what's available to you.
Absolutely. Sure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are there opportunities to put in more sustainable forms of transportation to Whistler and up there? Absolutely. You know, the buses, I don't know what the final tally on the bus program has been, but, you know, if we can see an enhancement of bus services that go up and back to Whistler, you know, that's going to help. You know, sustainability gets measured in lots of different ways. One of the things people said about the highway was is that it was dangerous to drive. And so, you know, if this improved highway, notwithstanding that, you know, there may be more traffic, you know, results in fewer accidents and fatalities, you know, how does that get factored into the equation of what was sort of the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's trade-offs in all the decisions that we make. My own personal feeling on the road is that, you know, that's something that sooner or later more work was going to be done on. And they were going to build, you know, a quicker or safer or more... you know, an expanded route to Whistler over time, much like we did through the interior of the province, and probably one day through sections of the Kootenays and Highway 3, we'll see, you know, improvements to road infrastructure. Should we be doing other things that are sustainable as well? Rail and buses and encouraging more local production and reducing our reliance on the need to truck things all over the place? Absolutely. But there's some trend lines on the way we've evolved and developed as people over 50 or 100 years that I don't think are just going to take a left turn.
Unfortunately, I mean, the change needs to be fast, and change takes a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And my thought is that, you know, you need a variety of approaches to try and make that change come to be. And
it certainly takes a very bold company or individual to make a really strong change.
Yeah.
But I'm of the opinion that maybe, you know, that's really the only way to go. Just looking at all the information we have about climate change now, and yeah.
Yeah, we do need to make bold decisions and be brave.
I like to talk about sustainability as communications,
because
sustainability is, you know, a verb. It's something that applies. You can apply to anything. It can be sustainable. One thing I wanted to touch on is the accountability, transparency, credibility of communications to the general public about the Olympics. And how do you feel that has gone? Do you think the public was well informed about what was going to happen, and was what happened consistent with what we were told?
I would say a couple of things there. You know, having had a bit of a role to play in some of the work around transparency, vis-a-vis reporting on environmental and sustainability things, I think that probably the access to information that people had, for those that wanted to go and find it, was probably pretty unprecedented. You know, this organizing committee, you know, went through the effort of collecting performance data on its environmental, its social, its economic aspects. It published that every year or every other year in reports. And most recently, they've brought in auditors, third-party auditors, to actually say whether or not it's accurate, or were the systems that generated the data fair and robust to be able to say your recycling rate is X, or that so many extra jobs were created during the Olympic Village. So, you know, that's not been done by an organizing committee before. And that's quite a high level of transparency around sort of claims that are being made on the environmental and social side. Mm-hmm. You know, does it tell the entire story? No, not entirely, because there's so many partners that are involved. So there's the provincial government, there's individual municipalities, there's the Canadian Olympic Committee. You know, we really need to understand what was going on with the collection of organizations, the event effectively, to really be able to understand some of the underlying details. But you asked about transparency. You know, so in terms of performance data, more than ever before, probably the number of public consultations and information sessions and workshop briefings on anything to do with business or, you know, labor, you know, having your staff, how is a business to react, you know, to having the Olympics in your community, effects for citizens from road closures and all that kind of stuff. I don't know, we already do a ton of kind of consultation type stuff in Vancouver or Canada. We're sort of more attuned to it. So probably, again, more than any other Olympics has ever done that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
On the big ticket things like board meetings, which were not always open to the public. Uh-huh. I think there, real opportunity for improvement, you know, and to relook at that. I think people would have felt a lot more comfortable and confident with decisions that were being made if that part of the process had been more open. You asked about follow through to bid commitments. I think probably there was more of a vision that there might have been maybe more transparency at that senior level than maybe played out.
Well, one thing that I know about is that the initial estimated cost for security was $135 million, and a lot of people were skeptical about that right from the beginning because it's significantly lower than past Olympics. I know someone who did a Freedom of Information Act request and also asked the RCMP, and the RCMPs said they're looking at more like $400 million, and this is before that's been public. Mm. So there's a real difference between what we're told and what only one body of security has told us.
Yeah.
And then, so this 135 number, I believe it stayed to be the number the public is given right until the province did an article last year that said, wait, actually the security cost is $900 million and growing.
Yeah. Final price tag is going to be $1 billion plus or minus.
Yeah.
I think it's perhaps one of the biggest questions that we need to be asking about the event. And it's in terms of its quote-unquote sustainability, and that is if such a huge proportion of the total cost, whether it's a small cost or a big cost, that so much of the cost goes to towards security, I think in and of itself, you know, is a question that we have to ask, you know, what's going on here? You know, what has resulted in a situation where there's such an enormous requirement and, you know, how come it's having to, you know, and why is there such a discrepancy between what was initially projected and what actually cost? I would say perhaps, in my own opinion, you know, more so than housing or green claims, you know, that's one where there was not an alignment or a congruence between what people were led to believe initially and what I think actually played out and people could have perhaps rightly projected would play out. And so I would say in terms of costs, I'm not sure the community should feel very good about the way that... I shouldn't say that they shouldn't feel good. I think the community rightly can have some questions about why there was such a big discrepancy and why that couldn't have been more clear right up front.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things. We could spend a lot of time on this. The IOC has an interesting perk to it from a business point of view in that being a non-central organization, they don't pay taxes anywhere and actually don't have to pay taxes on what they're doing. And more what I wanted to talk about, though, is that I've watched the movie Five Ring Circus, and it's a really great movie if you want to look at the Olympics from a different point of view, is that there's all these extra costs that are not being reported in the budget of the deficit of the Olympics, like the cost, I think the estimated cost is maybe around $6 million, but that actually doesn't include this.
Billion. Yeah,
that actually doesn't include the cost of security, and also the, which is another billion already, and also a lot of extra costs that are not being reported that are definitely, you know, related to the Olympics. So there's a certain transparency issue there as to what gets classified as Olympic expense and what does not.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's and you know these are no different than things. I think these issues that you're highlighting around the Olympics are good things to take a look at because in many ways they're no different than things that we see already in our day-to-day within the behavior of our companies, within the behavior of our public institutions. You know, there's a need for more accountability, more transparency, more responsibility.
What I'm interested in is how that ties to sustainability. Communications and sustainability are very important. Sustainable communications. When you're not transparent, you're losing your credibility to the people, and that is not sustainable.
Absolutely. And so that's why, you know, I think you see companies and organizations that are real leaders really place a high degree of emphasis around that kind of corporate transparency. So the corporate reporting that's going on around sustainability from groups like Vancity or Mountain Equipment Co-op on their factories, or Nike for that matter on their factories, or whoever the case may be, Royal Bank of Canada on, you know, corporate performance around social and environmental, you know, that stuff is interesting in terms of the change that it's driving, you know, shareholder activism as that more of that information is available, and you see groups like Ethical Funds and the work that Bob Walker is doing on to put pressure on public companies to change their practices, partly as a result that these groups now have more access to information that companies are self-disclosing and self-reporting. So, you know, we need more of that because, you know, be it at the product level or at the corporate level, an interesting thing, love them or hate them, that Walmart is doing is that they're putting more and more information on the source and origin and manufacturing process of products into their barcodes.
Yeah.
And in theory, a consumer can hold a PDA or an iPhone next to a product and see the website and learn more about the labor conditions or the pesticides on the banana plantation or whatever the case may be. Like I say, whether you love or hate Walmart, you do or don't like fair trade bananas, as a consumer, your ability to have access to that information to enable you to make whatever choice you want to make, you know, that's pretty cool.
I like the role that Reeves Consulting seems to have here in that they're promoting the public purchasing demand and putting that to corporations. But I think what we need for the public is for the public to make responsible purchasing. Otherwise, that demand will not. So I kind of see Reeves as...
We're trying to foster a more sustainable economy by getting people that spend a ton of money to really try and think more about making an ethical spend, a greener spend, a more sustainable spend, however you define it. Mm-hmm. We know that a lot of folks are taking baby steps to get started. You know, if Vanox spent $1 billion, well, we know for sure we got the ethical sourcing right on the branded merchandise, and that's a good piece of the pie, but there's still lots more that we could have done. Similarly, with many of the clients that we work with, you know, they might spend $1 or a few billion as a municipality a year on stuff. If we can start by getting 50 or 100 million really green or really sustainable or ensure that it's ethically sourced fabric or uniforms for workers or police or whatever the case may be, then we'll take on that next 50 million, then that next 200 million. And we believe that over time, institutions, corporations, municipalities, you know, government agencies will see that, you know, there's a lot of positive that comes from being eco-efficient in your supply chain by dealing with ethical suppliers, recruiting and attracting people to your company because they know you walk the talk in terms of how you spend your money, that those things will begin to change the economy into one that's hopefully more of a sustainable one that aligns more with what I think we intuitively know at our gut level is the kind of world that we want to live in. Whether you like capitalism or not, it is part of the way a lot of business is done. Our piece of it is to say, well, how can we green that up to the extent that we can?
Okay. Well, thank you very much for spending time with me here.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for the great questions. I really enjoyed that a lot. And, I really look forward to seeing these discussions continue because there are real issues that folks need to think about and talk about. And, you know, by working together, that's where we're going to find some of those sweet spots where the real innovation and solutions emerge from.
It's a work in progress.
For sure. Yeah, great.
Thanks. You're listening to Sustainable Futures on CGSF 90.1 FM. That was an interview with Tim Reeve of Reeve Consulting. And now we're going to go into our interview with Devin Page of EcoJustice. This is the first of a two-episode interview. In this episode, we're going to look at EcoJustice itself and some comparisons between the Canadian and American legal systems when it comes to the environment and some of the challenges of legal practice in defense of the environment in this episode. And then in the following week, we're going to look more at the bigger picture discussions of like things like how our actions reflect the legal system and how the legal system reflects our actions and how that all relates to sustainability in the environment. It's going to be more of a broad discussion in the second part, which will happen next week. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures. I have Devin Page of EcoJustice on the line. So welcome to the show, Devin.
Thank you for having me.
And let's begin with, what is EcoJustice?
EcoJustice is a nonprofit charity that provides free legal services to protect the environment.
So what kinds of legal services? Who's it for?
We represent anybody. So the typical clients that we have are the environmental community, the ENGO community, environmental nonprofit organizations. But We've represented private citizens, green businesses, trade unions, just about everybody that has an interest in protecting the environment and who needs a legal remedy.
Mm-hmm. How is that possible? How can it be free?
It's free because of the generosity of Canadians. So we're a charity that accepts charitable donations, and we raise currently about $4 million, the vast majority of which comes from individual Canadians, and that's just Canadians that give us $10 a month or $10 a year or whatever's in the coffee can. We've got one of the strongest widespread fundraising organizations in Canada, so we're fortunate.
I understand the group has roots in the Sierra Club. Is that correct?
Well,
or how does that work out?
The concept roots are in Sierra Club. So there was an organization started by Sierra Club in the States called Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. Mm-hmm. And one of their lawyers was practicing in Alaska who believed that we should have a similar organization in Canada. So in 1990, he with other people in the Vancouver community started Sierra Legal Defense Fund. The association with the organization to the south was informal. Mm-hmm. They eventually changed their name to Earth Justice, and then a couple of years we changed our name to Eco Justice, and we maintain an affiliation informally. Their executive director sits on our board of directors, and we try to collaborate as much as we can because they do what we do in the States and we do what they do up here. So it's been beneficial for us to be associated with them.
How does this work? Does someone contact you, and then what's the process? How's it all go about?
Well, there's two ways that cases arise at EcoJustice. Lots of times people don't know what the legal tools are that they could use to protect an environmental issue that they're confronted. So quite often we actually design the cases. We know what the law is. We know that there's a legal issue out there. So we'll sit around a table as a group of lawyers trying to decide whether or not there's an effective legal remedy to address environmental degradation. And if we identify that there is, we're pretty in tune with the environmental community to the extent that we can understand whether or not what their issues are. So sometimes we'll call up and say, here's what we've thought about. We know you guys are working on this issue. If you're looking for a legal remedy, we can work together. And quite often that collaboration then turns into the lawyer-client relationship, which turns into the legal case that we take to court. The flip side is the out-of-the-blue call. And you name it, we get all the calls. I mean, we currently have lawyers in BC, Alberta, and Ontario, but we have a national footprint and practice in any jurisdiction, so we get calls from anywhere. Mm-hmm. So you name it. I mean, we get calls from the Maritimes talking about landfill siting to fish farms on the Pacific coast. And typically it's, I have this problem, and I can't figure out how to solve it. It's that general. And they've come to us because they hope there's a legal remedy. The frustration is, I'd say about 90% of the time, we have to say to the public, there are no laws to protect the environment or to stop what you're concerned about. Mm-hmm. In a lot of respects, Canada is an environmental law backwater. It just hasn't caught up with the rest of the world in terms of how we regulate environmental degradation. Mm-hmm. But for the 10% of the times that people call, they identify an issue. A student does an original vet of the inquiry and decides whether the facts will meet the tests that are set out in the law or whether there's any law at all that would perhaps support them in their work. And then as a group of lawyers, we discuss and prioritize the work. And if it makes it through that filter, we say that we want to do this, and the last step is developing a memo that describes the parties and the facts and the law and getting board approval to proceed. And it sounds like a long, drawn-out process, but it can be a matter of weeks, and we've responded extremely quickly when, say, somebody's come to us and said we need a classic case was a couple of years ago. Somebody came to us and said they're going to dump diseased fish from a contaminated aquaculture site in the Fraser River. We need an injunction to protect the local ecosystem, and we turned it around in a day. So,
how is it possible to get all the lawyers to be working in this way? How do they get brought in? Is it volunteer for them as well, or how does that function? How does that come about?
They're paid. So as an organization, we maintain a staff of about 45 people across Canada, about 15 of which are lawyers. And, you know, we maintain the employee staff. We just pay lawyers a lot less than they can typically make in the private community. Mm-hmm. It makes it challenging for us over the past couple of years. It's been really challenging for the charitable community as a whole. I mean, the economic turmoil in the States and the effect that had on markets both in the U.S. and Canada directly related to a drop in revenues for us, for all charities. Mm-hmm. We've been keeping the ship afloat and balancing our budget through attrition, not filling positions, and mm-hmm. we just cling to maintaining a core group of some of Canada's leading environmental lawyers. It's a fairly small group, you know, for the type of work we do and the footprint that we have, but the good news is that we usually have a waiting list of people that want to join the organization. There's lots of lawyers out there that if they had the chance would love to work for us. We typically don't have positions for all the inquiries we have.
Mm-hmm. Supply is meeting demand then?
Yeah, it is. You know, if our constraint always is fundraising, and I feel totally fortunate, and it sounds like I'm just saying this, but there isn't a day goes by where I don't thank every person that takes $5 out of their coffee can to mail it into us uh-huh. for my job, and that's the way the lawyers here feel. But the constraint for us is how much money we bring in. We can only do the legal cases that we have money for, and to get the money, we have to raise it out there in the world, and it's tough to do that. Of the Canadian charitable philanthropic scene, only about 1% of the dollars that are given to charities go to environmental charities. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of work to do for not very much money, and mm-hmm. so we're no different from the rest of environmental charities, and it's a struggle to find the money. And if we find money, we put it to work. Last year, we designed and we're implementing a fairly robust fundraising plan that will hopefully allow us to increase revenues over the long term, and that will directly relate to hiring more lawyers and putting them in more places across Canada.
Mm-hmm. With the Canadian legal system then being behind the times, as you say, is there work that EcoJustice does to reconstruct the justice system? Is there new things put forward as suggested changes?
Yeah, we do. We, as a guideline, we devote about two-thirds of our energy to litigation, and we devote about one-third to law and policy reform. Mm-hmm. Devoting the two-thirds to litigation reflects our niche role, where there is no other organization in Canada that offers our services in the way we offer it and where we offer it. But we recognize at the same time that we can only offer legal remedies if there are laws that actually give us the power to enforce. Mm-hmm. So we have invested substantially in a couple of key legal law reform initiatives mm-hmm. in our history. And one classic example is that we've been working on protecting endangered species in Canada since the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. So for the first 10 years, that was work to try to get the federal government to pass endangered species legislation. And that was passed in 2002. We spent the last 6 years trying to get them to enforce it. So you know, the work never ends. Because Canada is, and it really is, I mean, when you compare, even comparing Canada to the United States, and sometimes people have the impression the United States is behind in terms of environmental protection. In so many ways, they're actually ahead. Mm-hmm. Part of that has to do, I think, with Americans believing that recourse to the courts is sort of a fundamental component of democracy. Mm-hmm. So people describe them as more litigious, but I think they actually think of themselves as more of a rights-based society, and included in that is the right to defend themselves in court. Mm-hmm. Canada, less so. Canada, we kind of think that if something is worth doing, the government will do it, mm-hmm. and if laws are necessary, the government will enforce it. So we actually spend a fair amount of our time communicating to Canadians the unfortunate message that the federal governments and the provincial governments haven't done a particularly good job of developing effective laws to protect the environment. In fact, they've done a pretty poor job. And so we do dedicate, just to close this, we do dedicate a portion of our resources to try to get governments to pass laws. And sometimes that means here's a law that you should pass. So we had the national campaign on species at risk, and just to continue on that theme, we have a current provincial campaign to try to get the BC government to pass species at risk legislation. BC has the most endangered species in Canada, has the most mm-hmm. species in Canada because of our natural variety. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the few, only two provinces that doesn't have legal protection for species at risk. So we have a current campaign right now with a bunch of NGO partners to try to get the provincial government to pass laws.
Is there an opposing force from other organizations that are doing just the opposite and putting forward laws to make it easier to get access to the environment?
Absolutely. So we are always a counterpart, quite often, to the resource extraction industry. Mm-hmm. And more frustrating, I'd say in the last 8 years, we've become a counterpoint to the government itself. Mm-hmm. Just like with the United States and the Reagan years and the swing to the right, Canada has experienced the same. Mm-hmm. And one of the unfortunate components of that shift has been a mindset that says that regulation that controls industry to protect the environment is bad for the public interest. So there's been a fairly strong campaign for at least the last 15 years, but it's even geared up in the last five, for what's generally described as deregulation, or getting rid of laws that constrain what we would call harmful behavior. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, leaving discretion to industry to decide how it should act. And I'll give you, if you want, I'll give you one perfect example that just happened in the last couple of days. So we were in the Supreme Court of Canada this fall arguing that the federal government had broken the law when it failed to fully assess a large mine that was proposed for, it's called the Sacred Headwaters, but it's the Stikine area in the north. It's called the Red Chris Mine. It was a large copper and gold open pit mine. And the federal government hadn't applied the Canadian environmental assessment laws that require a full assessment of the risks of that. In January, we got a decision from the Supreme Court of Canada that said that we and our clients were right and that the federal government hadn't done its job. And that decision changed the face of environmental law in Canada, because for the first time it was the Supreme Court saying, this law is here, it has to be applied, and you haven't been applying it. And the reason the government hadn't been applying it is because both the provinces and industry were pressuring them to relax the law, yeah. because they said it was bureaucratic red tape and that it cost them more than it benefited the environment. Well, the federal government is implementing a new budget, and yesterday we discovered inserted in the budget implementation bill were amendments to the federal laws on environmental assessment that effectively overturned the court decision and basically give the federal minister the right to arbitrarily exclude components of a project from environmental assessment. Basically, it allows the minister to get the federal government out of environmental assessment. That's a direct result of a provincial lobby and an industry lobby.
Is a budget a typical place to have something like this in the fine legal print?
No, it's absolutely rare, and we've come out condemning this practice. So this is sort of like what happens in the United States, and they call it adding riders to bills and hijacking legislation. Mm-hmm. We call it, or academia calls it, a legislative Trojan horse or a poison pill. And what they do is they know that the public has a distaste for elections. And the current approach is that if an opposition party votes down a budget, it's considered a confidence motion that triggers an election. So they attach significant substantive legislative amendments to a budget bill, where normally you might see, say, changes to the Income Tax Act. They attach, in this case, significant amendments to environmental protection legislation, knowing that the opposition parties have two choices. They can either swallow the amendments and let the budget go through and the business of government continue, or they can vote against the budget and trigger an election. And knowing the public distaste for that election, they put the opposition in an impossible position. Mm-hmm. So it's a way for them to basically skirt democracy mm-hmm. and get significant laws passed. And no, people normally, you know, maybe they complain about the actions of politicians, but typically they don't complain about the way that laws are made. At least they have an assumption Mm-hmm. That the parliamentary process is open, transparent, democratic, mm-hmm. somewhat thoughtful, and at least a place where debate occurs over the merit or demerit of prospective laws. Mm-hmm. This circumvents that in entirety. Mm-hmm. And it basically changes the law of the land without debate, without public exposure, in an attempt to circumvent that, and it's dishonest.
Right. How does a regular citizen just going about their daily life get this kind of information? How do they find out and see these documents, and then, above all that, understand the language and be able to know its implications?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, the answer is it's virtually impossible. We're fortunate that we found it because one of our lawyers has been specifically tracking environmental assessment legislation and the various discussions that are happening in Ottawa. But this material is at Section 1600 in a 900-page Budget Implementation Act.
Holy smokes.
There's absolutely no way Joe Public could know this was happening. And the government's not saying anything. I mean, in March when the government tabled its budget, they give a speech. And if I recall correctly, the speech said something about strengthening environmental legislation. It might have said strengthening environmental legislation through harmonizing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that gave nobody any signals that this was coming. Certainly didn't give us any signals that we watch for that kind of stuff. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. This was designed to avoid public scrutiny. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's starting to get some. I noticed that the Globe had an article on it today, and it's surfacing. And I hope it's surfacing because of public outrage.
Right.
If the government had its wishes, no one would know about it, and we wouldn't find out about it until later. And there's one thing that's worth commenting. I mean, what the government... Prentice has already come out and said, Federal Environment Minister Jim Prentice has already come out and said, hey, whoa, this is just technical. The reason for this is because we want to avoid duplication, knowing that provinces have complementary environmental assessment regimes. This just stops the same thing from happening twice. And that statement is just not true. So right now, a lot of provinces don't have environmental assessment regimes, so the federal assessment process was the only thing there was. And the provinces that do have it, they're fairly weak, spotty, discretionary. BC, one of the examples of deregulation was that when this current government in BC came into power, they immediately set to deregulating a lot of the environmental protection laws and the BC environmental assessment laws in particular. So now we have a weak discretionary law that, frankly, only had rigor in some circumstances because it was complemented by the federal law. So I'm saying there's not practically duplication. What I'm not saying is that it's not an inefficient process. The way that environmental assessment is conducted in BC right now isn't particularly efficient. Typically, that's because we've got a process that's based on the proponent of the project providing all the materials and not sufficient funding to participants so that they know what the risks are and how to respond to them. Mm-hmm. So if you're somebody that thinks you're going to be impacted by a mine downstream, and one of the current issues, and it was an issue in the court case before the Supreme Court, is turning lakes into tailings ponds. If you have a favorite lake in the backyard and you think there's going to be a development that threatens it, the environmental assessment process, in particular the changes that are being implemented in the budget, isn't going to help you be an effective participant. It's more likely going to hinder that.
So what can be done about this? Does EcoJustice have any ways of approaching this issue of these documents and finding ways to make it more readable and accessible and transparent? Are there motions in place to make a change for the public?
Well, you know, it's a good question. When people ask me what they can do to protect the environment, I can talk about it from our perspective and say what the environment needs is stronger laws that we can enforce.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the mood, what I sometimes say is electoral reform. If at the end of the day we're meaningfully intend to ensure the environment's protected, we need to change our system of government so that you can't do something that's undemocratic like this. And the irony is, this minority government, the irony is that they're able to do something like this, that it just speaks to a process that's broken. So potentially its electoral reform, things like proportional representation, so that you could ensure that you had a government that was representative of interests. And I'm not proposing that as a panacea. I just see it now that we have a system that isn't working to ensure that there's an appropriate process for how we design and implement and enforce laws. So the what you do about it is people really have to talk to their politicians. This is one for everybody. This is one where whether somebody thinks conservative or liberal, I bet they all think that there should be transparency and public discourse around fundamental changes to law.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to talk to their represented elected officials and tell them what they think.
My observation, too, is that this happens on all levels. I've often been to town and city hall meetings where things are not exactly transparent and there isn't much debate going on. And have you observed something similar to this? Is this something that just happens on all levels?
You know, the many systems in Canada, and you're talking, you know, municipal, provincial, or federal, the system really is designed to let you hide something if that's what you want to do. And I'll give one other example to distinguish between Canada and the United States. And I'm not going to stay on environmental assessment, but I'll start from that. One of the tenets of environmental assessment is public involvement. And for the public to be involved, they have to understand what the process is.
Mm-hmm.
So the federal process employs a public registry where people are entitled to documents that describe what the process is. Now let's contrast that with the BC system and talk about these run-of-river power projects, which frankly are just dams on smaller streams. Because the BC government has chosen to ensure that those are constructed by third parties, contracting out and not having BC Hydro, the Crown Corporation, do them,
mm-hmm.
they've sought to circumvent the laws that allow access to information, freedom of information.
Yeah.
So that suddenly the third-party agreements, the companies challenge their obligation to disclose the terms and things like that because of the fact that they're an independent party.
Right.
That's regressive, and it's kind of the opposite of what you're seeing in so-called progressive jurisdictions around the world. You can contrast what happens in BC related to how decisions are made with what's happened in the United States. So in BC, if we want to find out about that kind of stuff, we have to do an FOI request. Invariably, the request is delayed far beyond the guidelines that are in the law.
Information.
That's it.
Yeah.
And we very often find ourselves representing clients, challenging a decision before the commissioner, and then if people don't like the fact that we got the information, they'll take that to court, and we have to go to court. In the United States, a lot of the information that we are fighting in the courtrooms to try and get is publicly available on the Internet. It's one example of how they've made a commitment to transparency as a component of democracy, where they just publish so much more, and it's just out there. And the change is so radical, it's hard to describe. I mean, literally, you go on the Internet, and all of a sudden you're seeing all these contracts and agreements and things like that that describe the relationship between the government and an industry. And in Canada and in BC, you have to fight like crazy to get your hands on that kind of stuff.
And why do you think this difference exists? Is there a recent reason that the American system has been more accessible, or is it something that's always been this way, or how has it come to be as it is, where there's this striking difference between the two?
I don't know the entire history. All I know is the difference. Pieces that I've seen that have informed that have something to do with, again, this notion of a more involved notion of rights. So love it or hate it, there is more of a sentiment or ethic in the United States that people have the right to certain things and the right to defend themselves. Unlike, as I was saying earlier, perception in Canada that the government looks out for your best interest. In the United States, people look out for their individual best interest. Now, that you know, that can lead to a society that maybe isn't that protective of people or the environment, but when it shines in the way that reflects probably the best of democracy. And in my mind, one of the components of the best democracy is transparency around decision-making. And how do you affect that transparency? You publicly disclose things that are material. And they do that in the States, and we just don't do it here. You know, and it's funny, maybe it has something to do with describing the difference between U.S. and the Commonwealth, because it's actually not uncommon in Commonwealth countries to have to fight for information that you normally assume is should be just open to the public, yeah. Period.
Right.
So there has been historically a difference between the United mm-hmm. States and other countries.
Yeah, and the United States history is a little bit unique as well, and just the very fundamental basis of how that country started is a bit different. So that could be a part of it. I'm going to change track a little bit here, and I'm going to get a little more general with you. And how does the way people act affect law, and how does law affect the way in which people act?
Well, it's a good question. It is a good question. You know what I'd start off by saying is how people live has radically affected the law. And I'll try not to be long-winded, but I'll give you one example. The average footprint of a North American person, the ecological footprint, how much of the Earth's resources do we draw? And to translate that, how much land do we need for one North American person to sustain their current lifestyle as opposed to somewhere else in the world? So the average ecological footprint of a North American person is about 6 to 8 hectares. People are interested. They can find that in both the WWF report that came out last year and also some research that originated at Yale University. And that 6 to 7 hectare footprint can be contrasted with someone in a third world country where it's around 1, mm-hmm. or in China where it's around 2. So we draw about 3 times the amount of resources from the planet that the majority of the world's people do. Another way of looking at it is the average North American eats about 2,500 calories a day, whereas in a lot of places in the world, they eat about 1,000. And they eat about 1,000, they're not on a starvation diet. They're actually eating what the body needs to sustain itself.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we're just too rich, and we've moved in the last 50 years from a place where we were manufacturing goods to meet all the needs that people have, mm-hmm. to a type of economy where what we really do is we manufacture needs so that people buy goods that we can produce because we're so technologically advanced. So when you think about it, probably before the First World War, but certainly right after the First World War, people had largely their needs met. So they had, you know, they had cars, they had homes, and they had kitchens, and they had washing facilities. So they didn't just have their elemental needs, but they even had what they thought were luxuries.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, you know, we just started to produce more and more and more.
Right.
And how do you do that? Well, you have to basically change people's behavior and attitudes to mm-hmm. get them to design artificial needs mm-hmm. so that business can stay in business and profit can be maximized. And that has taken us to a point where consumption drives economies a lot more than it ever did. So right now, in the United States, about 70% of the economy is on the backs of consumption and consumer products and meeting consumer needs. And you can't say the same thing about Canada because we don't do our economics the same way as they do in the United States. But there was a survey that was done by the Chartered Accountants of Canadians and their saving, and they found that in recent years, saving has declined, and in 2008, it reached its lowest level, and people were actually borrowing from themselves in a way because they were increasing their mortgage for the purpose of buying consumer products. And most commentators say that effectively that is the same thing. And I'm going to get to how it's changed laws, but you have to talk about how it's changed society. And it's interesting, watching that transformation means watching how marketing and advertising and branding have transformed the marketplace. So that's sort of become the core to the economy right now, how you can market and brand as opposed to how you can just build something.
Going to cut off the interview at that point, and you'll hear the rest of that track of dialogue in the next week's episode, April 9th. And thank you for listening to Sustainable Futures. Unfortunately, we do run out of time when the time runs out. And if you'd like to hear this or any preceding episode of Sustainable Futures. I will periodically post them up on radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. So thank you very much for listening. This is episode number 52, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.